hope to interest you in this last talk in something that's going on in biology right now that is really being driven by data, by evidence, which is a wonderful thing in science, for the evidence to be in the driver's seat rather than theory. And what I'm going to describe in the next 45 minutes or so is something that I never expected to see as a student, even as a graduate student. I was a graduate student at the University of Chicago from 1985 till 1997. Part of that time we were living in Boston because my wife was a fellow at Harvard. Both of our daughters were born in Boston, so I consider each daughter half a PhD. That's why it took me 12 years. But in that 12-year interval, from 1985 to 1997, a revolution began in biology challenging the view that all life on Earth can be traced to a single common ancestor, that is, to a single cell. That is Darwin's tree. Now, in January last year, New Scientist magazine, which is a British science publication, had a cover story, Darwin Was Wrong, Cutting Down the Tree of Life. And as you can well imagine, this article generated quite a bit of controversy. Many biologists were very unhappy, said, I'll never have anything to do with New Scientist magazine again. But the article did not address intelligent design or creation or any alternative to an evolutionary view in the broad sense. What it described was a series of discoveries that have led biologists to doubt whether there was that one progenitor cell that gave rise to all life as we see it today. Now, there's something amiss. There's something amiss in this title. It's not really Darwin's tree. And I've used that phrase in my own title, but really that's a bit misleading, because if you look at The Origin of Species, the book that started modern evolutionary theory, there's only one picture in the whole book, and here it is. And it's a branching diagram where we have time here going from the past to the present, and then diversity or differences arising along the horizontal axis. So life is branching and expanding. It's a picture familiar to you, I imagine. But notice it does not depict a single tree. There are 11 starting points here. The letters A through L, excluding the letter J, which does not occur in Latin. And Darwin was a good classically trained young English gentleman, so he wouldn't use a J. You've got 11 starting points here, with some suggestion in the diagram that they may converge to other ancestors further down. But that's not actually what the picture shows. It doesn't show a single tree. If anything, it shows a kind of forest or mangrove type pattern. And this picture reflects Darwin's own ambivalence about whether life had one ancestor or several. And he was always very cagey about whether he wanted to push his argument back to a single starting point or whether there were multiple starting points. He left that open. So really what we should say is that, and you can see this here, this is Darwin's view in The Origin of Species. This is the second edition now, and he's added these words, by the Creator. So in the first edition it said, having been breathed into a few forms or into one. And then in the second edition he adds these words, by the Creator, the capital C is his, and he never takes them out. And a number of his friends teased him for this, and he grumbled about it in his private correspondence. He said, well, I caved in to public opinion. But it's clear that he regarded the origin of life as something probably qualitatively different than the rest of the evolutionary story. So there's significant ambiguity in Darwin's own thinking when you get down to the root of the tree of life. And what I want you to see here is this phrase, few forms or one. A few forms would be that. Maybe 11 starting points, not a single one. So really what the cover of The New Scientist should have said is that neo-Darwinism is wrong, the modern theory of evolution, because in that theory, Life does have a single starting point. Or that is, all organisms are related to a single starting point. Life might have begun, might have started on this planet many times, but only a single ancestor survived. So Jerry Coyne is a biologist, a geneticist at the University of Chicago. I've debated him on Canadian television. He's an aggressive proponent of Darwinism, in fact, of atheism. Has a very lively blog where he talks about that. And he says in this passage, any two extant species share a common ancestor. So your dog and you, if you trace back mammalian history, there'll be an organism that is your common ancestor. You take your dog and a trout out here in a stream or a salmon in the ocean, trace back them, you'll find a common ancestor. Or the bacteria in your gut and you have a common ancestor. Now, I'll explain that in a bit more detail later. What I want to do, though, is tell you that that view is breaking up. So here's an outline of what I'll tell you in the next 45 minutes. First, we want to look at a logical framework for understanding this theory of common descent, which I'll abbreviate CD, and it's helpful because it's Charles Darwin's initials. Explain how Darwin and modern evolutionary biologists see this being tested. We have to be able to test the theory. There's a principle that I'll explain that does that job. And lastly, we'll save the best for last, we're going to look at multiple lines of evidence that are now challenging this common descent picture. Now, my remarks this afternoon are based on work that I've done over the past decade with this biologist, Lee Van Valen, who was on my dissertation committee at Chicago. He does not agree with me about this, by the way. I need to be very clear about this. We have a friendly discussion, I guess you could say, a friendly antagonism. He supports my project. I'm hoping to publish this in his series, Evolutionary Monographs. He's the editor. We've been working on it for a long time. And I put this up here because I want to acknowledge his role in helping me think about these issues. Now, the tree of life is usually depicted this way, as a tree, where you have the last universal common ancestor down here. This is our ultimate grandparent, if you will. And let's say this is Homo sapiens here. And then there is a long branching pattern tying together all of life going back to that starting point. This kind of picture is probably familiar to you. The problem for my purposes today is this is graphically difficult to work with. It's awkward for the kind of logical points that I want to make. So I'm going to use a different picture. A closed domain. Okay, so think of this as a very, very large sphere. It's represented here in only in two dimensions. Imagine it as a very large sphere. And within that sphere is every living thing on Earth that's currently alive today, plus everything on this planet that was ever alive. Dinosaurs that we heard about earlier this afternoon, trilobites, you name it, if it was alive, if it was respiring, if it was making a living as an organism on this planet, it's somewhere within this large sphere, and there's nothing outside it. Now, that is a very general, in fact, it would be the most general or universal theory in biology, because every living thing falls within that domain and there's nothing outside it. So that's the picture I'll use, and it's actually very helpful in terms of illustrating the logic of the theory. Now, there's an important distinction that we need to keep in mind. When I say that I challenge common descent, and I do, what I challenge is the view, which I've illustrated here by these capital letters, that all living things on Earth come from a single parent. That doesn't mean that I reject common descent with a small c, small d. In fact, everyone in this room, I think, would accept this view of common descent, small c, small d, because we know that we have parents, and our parents had parents, and so forth, and if you run those lineages backwards, they converge, and they come to original starting points. So the difference here is this is a single parent. Here we have n plus 1, where n is a number to be determined. It might range up to many hundreds of starting points, many thousands of starting points. We don't know. We have to investigate. But there's a there is a difference here in the number of starting points. And you need to keep this distinction in mind, because often dissenters from evolutionary theory are challenged by someone saying, well, how can you possibly reject common descent? All organisms have parents. It's just as obvious as the day is long that common descent is true. What they mean is this, but what they actually are asking you to accept is this. And there's an important difference there that we need to maintain. Here are two kind of fancy names for the difference. Monophily versus polyphily. The root here means single branch. So all life on Earth stems originally from a single branching point. Here we have multiple branching points. So this is just a fancier way of making the same distinction. And we can get at the logic here using an informal set theoretic definition. So, for any organism P, you, your dog, a tree, bacterium, doesn't matter, any organism P has at least one member in common, when you look at its set of ancestors, with any other organism Q. So here's a simple way of looking at this. Here are my ancestors, the beginning of the set anyway, my mom and dad, both alive and well, living in the eastern United States. Now, my grandparents are all dead, but I know who they were. We can run this set out all the way back on this view to the last universal common ancestor, Luca. There it is, our ultimate grandparent on this view. Well, I used Chris here as my other example. Now, our point of I don't know if his parents are alive, I'll bet they are, but even if they're not, we can still put them in there. The point of intersection between his ancestors and my ancestors will be remarkably recent, much more recent, I think, than many of us realize. Pretty much any human being that you ever meet is your kin, and you can find the point of commonality, if you care to do it, using genealogical data. But it turns out that, for instance, Obama is an eighth cousin of Dick Cheney, which caused some merriment during the last presidential campaign. It's amazing that for Northern Europeans, you can find your point of common ancestry with any other Northern European very, very quickly, but you can really do this for any human being on Earth. So we'll find kin that we have in common, probably in Northern Europe somewhere, not very long ago. But eventually, of course, we'll, according to this view, we'll both have Luca. Now, let's expand it a little bit. Pine tree. Okay, now the point of intersection here where we find the ancestors in common is going to be very close to the origin of eukaryotes, that is, cells that have a nucleus. We're going to go way back now, billions of years in Earth history. And if we want to go way back, we'll look at the bacteria in our gut. Now the point of common intersection is going to be close to Luca itself, if not, in fact, Luca. But you see the idea here. You've got these branching trees that are converging as you go back in time. There's a little phylogeny showing how you could draw this in a branching diagram. And I'm not saying, by the way, that I'm more highly evolved than Chris. Now, this theory is the gateway into modern biology, modern evolutionary biology in particular. This is a textbook I used as a student. Look at the page number here. It's the first thing you learn as you open the book. What's our fundamental premise, these authors are saying? All living things are descended from a common ancestor that lived in the remote past. Well, if you do what I did, the set theory, the only way that can be true is if there was a cell that we all descend from. Here's another textbook I used, making the same point. Again, look at the page number. It's the gateway into the discipline of evolutionary biology. This is the fundamental premise that you must accept to do this science. Now, there's our domain. And polyphily just says there never was that common ancestor. So we go back and we look at our sets. While Chris and I may intersect somewhere in Northern Europe or even further back, if we look at all four sets, we're not going to find one member that they all share in common. And again, if you do the branching diagram, what you find then is these lineages come to independent starting points. They don't converge to a singularity. And the domain goes away. And then it becomes an open question, how many groups are here? So you can think of this, imagine you've got a little forest of trees and you're looking at it top down and you come through that forest, let's say these are little saplings, with a chainsaw and you cut them all off near the ground and then you take a picture of that top down. What we're looking at here in this little forest are the trunks of trees that have independent roots. They don't converge to a single point. So here you'd say, well, you've got six starting points, maybe more, because you've got to account for these two as well. Now, when I was a student studying evolutionary biology, common descent was part of the furniture of reality. If you were properly educated in science, or really properly educated at all, it's just something you took to be the case, just the way we would say, as we heard in the previous talk about cosmology, well, everyone knows that the Earth goes around the sun. That's just part of reality. That's what reality is. We know that molecules are made up of atoms and so forth. So Ernst Mayr, great neo-Darwinian biologist at Harvard, had a productive career right up into 100 years old. He's dead now. But in this book, he said, there's nobody left who questions this. Actually, when he wrote that, it wasn't true. But he was sort of conveying the spirit of the time. Francisco Ayala, a former Catholic priest who's now an evolutionary biologist at the University of California, put it this way. He said, this is established with a certainty similar to that of notions like the roundness of the Earth, the motion of the planets, and so forth. Well, what that suggests is that it's very dangerous to question this idea. At least it was until recently. So here's a little table. And in science, there are some topics, think of this as a crystal bowl, they're right in the middle of the table. They're perfectly safe. Safe in the sense that you can have a career looking at them, and you can get your research funded. Don't forget the second part. Those are the safe topics. Then we've got some risky ones. You can probably build a career on it. You may not get funding. It's much more dangerous to consider these topics. That bowl has been shoved over now near the edge where it might topple off. Questioning common descent is down here. At least it was when I was a student. In fact, when I got to graduate school, I wanted to write my dissertation on this topic, and I used to go to science meetings or colloquia, and I would approach biologists and I would say, have you ever wondered about common descent? You know, whether it might be false, or we could challenge it, and they would sort of like glance down at their watch, you know, and be like being cornered at a party by somebody who thought that all the plays of Shakespeare had been written by Francis Bacon, you know, and you just can't get away from this person, or someone who's a Kennedy assassination conspiracy advocate. I hope nobody has that view in here. If I did, I apologize for offending you, but you know what I mean, someone that's sort of a socially inept, bringing up a topic that they don't really want to talk about. And what I discovered is that began to change, is that biologists were beginning to say, you know, I do have doubts about it. So maybe it isn't downright cranky to question this theory. The important logical point, though, is that even if the theory were in the center of the table here, we would still want to know how we could test it. We would not want to accept it as an axiom, as just something given by the universe that we must accept. We'd still want to know, since we came up with this theory, if it were false, how would we know? So here's Philosophy of Science 101. We have our theories here. We have all the data, the evidence here. And theories give us expectations about the world. They tell us, go out and look for the following. And that's why they're useful, because they're tools that help us compress experience best form in a simple mathematical expression, then we can go out and look at the world and say, what are we going to find today on the basis of what the theory tells us? But to have a healthy science, the world needs to be able to talk back to us, because it's in this cycle that we learn how these are false. Dr. Bile talked about that in his presentation. So if we've got the theory of common descent and it tells us to go out and look for certain things, and they're not there, that evidence should be able to talk back to us to tell us, you know what, this isn't true. And this, you think of this like a two-lane road. There has to be traffic freely moving in both directions. So here's the question I ask, first in my dissertation, but now in this book I'm working on. If the theory were false, how would we know? We're not going to hold it as an axiom. It's not going to be a given. We have to be able to test it. Now, you would think that should be an easy question to answer, right? A theory that's universally quantified, that applies to every living thing on Earth, we should be able to test it absolutely everywhere. Because every organism that we see is affected by that theory, that means that we have all kinds of different lines of data that might challenge it. Well, that actually isn't so within evolutionary theory. This turns out to be a very hard question to answer. And the reason why, I think, is quite interesting. But let's first look at Darwin's proposal for how he was going to answer that question. At this point in the book, first edition, this is about halfway into the book, Darwin knows that you, his reader, are going to have all kinds of doubts and questions for him. Remember, at the time, in the middle of the 19th century, most educated people in England, his natural readership, thought that living things were created by God. He's trying to persuade them out of that. So about halfway into the book, he realizes a significant amount of tension has built up in his readership that he's got to relieve. So he has a chapter right in the middle of the book on the objections to his own ideas. So he's saying, all right, you've been listening to me politely for 4 or 5 chapters. I know you've got a lot of questions. Let's deal with them now. So in this section, he says, here is one way that I would know if my theory weren't true. He puts it this way: if it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. Now, don't be misled by these adjectives. I'll come back to that in a moment. Darwin thought that evolution would be gradual because gradual evolution was more likely than not to be successful, but that doesn't really matter for the logic of the test. But let's look at the first kind of proposal that he made. He actually made this in a letter to Asa Gray. Asa Gray was a Christian at Harvard, a botanist, a close friend of Darwin, and a theistic evolutionist. Gray thought, for instance, that variations in living things did not occur randomly, but were designed by God. And they wrote back and forth a lot of letters where Gray would argue with Darwin, asking him, for instance, how would you know if your theory were not true? And finally, Darwin said to Gray, all right, I'll paraphrase, look, here's how I would know. Imagine that we found a being like us, but made entirely of metal. So it's Iron Man. If we found such a being, said Darwin, I would have reason to doubt my theory. Why? So let's locate that point out here in space. It's outside the domain of common descent. So there's Iron Man out there, this metallic being. Darwin says, I would have reason to doubt my theory because there would be no natural pathway from the rest of life to that metallic being. So if that really existed, my theory couldn't be true because there would be a point outside the domain, and common descent has to include everything. Since it doesn't, the theory would be false. But then in the very next sentence to his friend Asa Gray in the letter, he says, but this is childish writing. He didn't really believe it, but he was proposing a test. Now, the interesting thing is, in the origin, he takes this test and actually applies it in a very sober way. He says, if we could find something that couldn't be built by any natural pathway, my theory would break down. But think about this for a moment. There's a logical problem here. If common descent applies to everything on Earth, everything's already inside the domain. It's already there. So how could you test it if you've already postulated that everything falls within that sphere? Trilobite, oak tree, blue whale, T-Rex, it's all within there. There's a logical problem. You can't apply Darwin's test. What could be out here? Well, biologists looking at this problem came up with a solution. They used a kind of proposition called a conditional counterfactual. Now, that's a fancy name for something that you use all the time. You just probably don't apply that name to it. Darwin and evolutionary biologists since his time have proposed conditional counterfactuals, as tests. What they say is, look, if it were the case that X, where X is something we're going to fill in, some observation, then we would know that common descent is false. Where the first clause, the part of the sentence before the comma, is always false. That's why it's called a counterfactual. It's conditional in the sense that we say, well, if we saw that, then we would know that the theory was false. We haven't seen it yet, but we might. So here's an example of how we might use one of these in daily life. And you've done it, you just don't give it a name. And I hope I never see this. I have a rather large library at home in Chicago. But I can imagine, like on this trip, I'll be home tomorrow afternoon, pulling up in my Honda Odyssey, and there are 2,000 books piled along the curb, the contents of my research library. That's my wife. Okay? I can imagine states of affairs that, if I saw them, would indicate a certain result to me. This one I hope I never do see, but that's likely the signal that I would take away from that event if I saw it. Or maybe she found bed bugs in my study and we needed to fumigate everything. But you do this all the time. If X, therefore Y. Haven't seen X, but I might. All right, let's take this back into biology. I'm sure many of you have heard this, probably in conversation if you haven't read it on the web. Someone will say, well, I know how evolution would be false. If we found a rabbit in Precambrian strata, a fossil of a mammal, way down where it shouldn't be, we would have reason to doubt the truth of common descent. So Douglas Fatuma, whom I mentioned this morning in his book, Defending Evolution from Creationist Attack, put it this way. He said, I can imagine how I would know that this theory were false if I found Bugs Bunny down in Precambrian strata, a fossil way out of place where it should not be. Now, most people read this and they say, well, that's just obvious. Of course, if we did find that, we'd have reason to doubt. Let's press on, though, and ask why. Why would we have reason to doubt the theory? Well, here's our little timeline, past to present. Here's Cambrian back 550 million years ago, let's say, and here's where we are today. So we find rabbits today, and that doesn't lead us to challenge the theory. But if we found them back here, says Fatuma, we'd have a real problem. Why? Well, the view is that, just to show you the little cartoon here, we locate that point out there in space. That's not our counterfactual that we don't expect to see, but we might. If we found rabbits back there, we would doubt common descent. Why? Because on this view, it's biologically impossible for rabbits to have occurred there. Here is a Cambrian chordate, now extinct. It has a dorsal nerve cord. So this is an evolutionary view, a very early representative of our phylum, the Chordata. The argument is you couldn't go from this form to that form directly, bypassing the rest of evolutionary history. To build a mammal on this view, you need to pass through all the rest of the long lineage connecting these two forms, where you go through fish, tetrapods, land-dwelling forms evolve, reptiles, mammal-like reptiles, and so forth, and eventually, in the Cenozoic, the appearance of rabbits. That bottom passage can't happen because it's biologically impossible. So if we saw that, we'd have reason to doubt the common ancestry of these forms. Now, that hasn't been seen. That's a counterfactual. But we can still put it out there in space and say, well, you know, if we saw that, we'd have reason to think that this domain was not universal. Well, this method of reasoning has come to have a name in evolutionary theory. It's called the principle of continuity. And when I discovered this as a graduate student, discovered in the sense that I was made aware of it in my reading of the evolutionary literature, then I started to see it absolutely everywhere, because it's a key tool that evolutionary biologists use to judge the plausibility of each other's scenarios. And it's simplicity itself. So let's say we have a hypothesis that B evolved from A along some pathway. All right, so we say, well, where did B come from? Well, B evolved from A and it evolved along this pathway. That's our evolutionary hypothesis. Now, the principle of continuity simply says, all right, if that's your hypothesis, every point in that pathway must be biologically possible. And these are independent of each other. So you're not automatically able to claim that B evolved from A without being able to satisfy the requirement that every point in that pathway could have happened. You've got to keep that independence condition in mind, because that's the only way that the principle of continuity can act as a judge on that hypothesis. Let me give you another non-biological example to help drive the point home. Suppose you're at a barbecue or a dinner with your Uncle Bob. And he's a garrulous type. He likes to talk. And he says, you know what? Last year I was in the UK and I swam from Dover to Calais unassisted. I swam the channel. All right, so he says, there's Dover, there's the French coast. He made the crossing, swam it by himself, didn't get written up in the papers, but I actually did it, he tells you. So you're sitting there with your Coke in your hand and your plate of baked beans, and you're looking at him, and you say, you know what, Bob, you're a likable guy, but I have some other information. You're a little obese. Furthermore, you are a very heavy smoker. This independent information casts doubt on what you're telling me. It's possible, but I don't think so. Furthermore, you got another piece of information. Now, what does this independent information do to the plausibility of his claim? Well, it destroys it, or it puts it in very serious doubt. Very serious doubt. That's how the principle of continuity functions, in a sense, in terms of its logic in biology. So, for instance, I talked about this morning, you can't do this. You can't be temporarily dead, even for a moment. If your trajectory requires this population of organisms to pass through a stage where they're inviable, that cannot be the path by which B evolved. And biologists use this requirement all the time when someone is saying, well, you know, I think X could have happened. They say, you know what, you've got a stage there along that pathway where you're not able to reproduce, you're not able to feed yourself, there's some deep functional problem that could not have happened. Now, I've pointed this out earlier, but I want to stress it again because I'll come back to it. These entities, if you will, theoretical entities, the theory of common descent itself plus a principle of continuity have got to be independent. If they're not, common descent becomes functionally an axiom. So this body of knowledge, which is really everything else we know from biology, has to be able to rule on the truth or falsehood of this theory in order for this to act as a test. It's like having an umpire. In baseball, the guy at home plate is not allowed to argue with the umpire about whether or not a strike was a strike or a ball, or to say, you know what, for the sake, I really hit that ball way down there. I know it's in the parking lot and it's not on this side of the third baseline, but you know, I really hit it down there. I'm going to first base. This is the umpire, and the umpire has the final word if the principle of continuity really is an umpire. I've said this already, it's used everywhere. Let me just give you a couple of quick examples. Leslie Orgel was a researcher at the Salk Institute in San Diego, came from England, who worked on the origin of life. He was an RNA chemist. And in this paper, where he deals with the problem of the origin of the genetic system that we know from biology today, he says, I'm going to be guided by a principle of continuity which says that each stage has to arise continuously. You've got to be able to make sure biological plausibility is satisfied. He says, if we do this, we have a real problem. The system that we know today, the nucleic acid system that produces proteins, could not have arisen from a different kind of chemistry. Why? Because at some point you're going to have to pass all the information from that other chemistry over to the one that we know, maintaining continuity all along the way, and at some point you will pass through that gulf, and you can't do that. It's like taking a plane off that when you leave the airport is a Piper Cub, or let's say a canvas and wood biplane, and while it's flying, you're gonna rebuild it into a fighter jet, keeping it in the air, and then you're gonna land a fighter jet. It's impossible, is his argument. You can't pass that information across that gulf, so whatever chemistry we see here must be preserved in terms of continuity back down to the original precursors. And you can use it in other places, and in fact, it is used in other places in biology. Lewis Wolpert is an English developmental biologist who works on the problem of evolution. And in this publication, he was asking, how did the animal body plans arise? We talked about that a little bit this morning. One view is that they had a larval ancestor, a very simple, relatively uncomplicated organism that gave rise to these different groups. But he says, I can't buy that because it violates the continuity principle. How could a larva evolve the ability to metamorphose into adults when the intermediate stages required are improbable? So to go back to our figure here, if this is an adult with the body plan, let's say, of an arthropod, like a lobster or a crab, and it had an unknown larval ancestor that wasn't a lobster or a crab, Wolpert argues at some point you've got to jump that gulf and you can't do it. Now, it's quite simple. I'm sorry, someone in the audience told me that this is not the negation sign, it's the approximately sign. But my character set when I made these slides did not have the negation sign. So what this means is not approximately. So what we're saying is common descent requires that the principle of continuity be satisfied. If it's not, common descent is false. The logic could not be more straightforward. The problem is, in that competition between common descent and the principle of continuity, common descent is favored every time. Until recently, as I'll tell you in a moment. But in practice, most evolutionary biologists, when they're confronted with a challenge to common descent, will protect common descent. Think about it this way. Imagine you've got a medieval castle, and deep in the center of that castle is the throne room. And in the center of the throne room is the queen on her throne. And let's say we go out to the outer wall of the castle, then we find the moat, then we find the village or the city outside, and the barbarians are crashing in. They're crossing the moat, they're entering the castle, and the queen is never reached because she's buried deep within that castle, and everyone who actually dies is in some outer ring. That's a picture of what happens with common descent. The theory is privileged and isolated, placed in that room in the center of the castle. So when anomalous data, when observational challenges arise, they never actually make it over to the queen. Some other part of the castle, some other person has to pay. In other words, what happens in practice is common descent is privileged over everything else that we know. And that's a problem. Because then that turns this theory into an axiom. It takes it out of testable science and makes it an a priori. It makes it something that you've just got to accept come what may. And that's not healthy for science. So here's another way of thinking about the problem before we get to the data. Here's common descent, and we can't see this. This is a theoretical construct par excellence. It happened over, if it did happen, 3.8 billion years on this planet. So the structure that we're describing goes deep into the history of life on a standard geological view, which we haven't observed. So how can we possibly test it? Well, we can test it if we link it to other parts of our biological knowledge that we can observe, and then that lets us make predictions. So we can link common descent to our knowledge of how biochemistry works. And then that lets us predict, let's say, biochemical invariance. A ribosome, the machine in the cell that makes proteins. Every living thing has one, from the simplest bacterium to a blue whale. We all have ribosomes in every cell of our body. Well, except for some exceptions like blood cells. So, ribosomes have a particular function that's well understood experimentally, parts that they need that they can't do without. Well, if we couple common descent to what we know from biochemistry, that leads us to predict, well, pretty much every ribosome we look at should have the same structure because they're all inherited from a common ancestor over here. So let's do a thought experiment. This is the only kind of experiment that philosophers are legally entitled to do. Let's generate a prediction from common descent. Now, I'm going to show you a little video. It's about 2 minutes, 2.5 minutes long maybe. Really beautiful. You can download it freely on the web. That shows you the ribosome in action. This molecular machine is going to come together. It has two parts, a small part and a big part. Actually, it has dozens of parts, but the major ones are what's called the small subunit and the large subunit. They're going to join around a long, colorful strand of messenger RNA, and they're going to generate a protein. Now, there's one step in the process I want you to pay attention to. It comes at the end, and then we'll use that to do our thought experiment. So, let's see if we can get this to run. Here we go. So this long, colorful strand is the messenger RNA. That's what is carrying the information that will be turned into the protein. So here now, the small subunit is coming together. These are accessory proteins that help get the process started. So it's come together around the start site. Now, here comes the large subunit, fastens on. And now what's going to happen is the whole machine will work its way down that messenger RNA strand. These accessory proteins go off. So the first step is elongation, and what's coming in here is a transfer RNA. It's carrying at this end an amino acid, and up here in the peptidyl transferase site, the amino acid here, which is a piece of a protein, and the one here in the start codon will form a peptide bond. So that's the first link being formed in this chain. This accessory protein, elongation factor, comes in to help translocate the whole machine, to help it move, and it does move. There's considerable molecular motion here along the messenger RNA strand. Remember, the peptide, the protein itself, is forming up here at this end of these transfer RNAs. Now, that one goes out. This one will come out of this site, because the whole machine's going to move, and another transfer RNA will come in, carrying up here an amino acid. It'll form a bond there. See, that one exits from the exit site. Now we'll speed this up to something more like real time. Actually, it's moving much, much faster than this. So it's reading the messenger RNA strand, and out of a special channel in the large subunit comes the baby protein. Here are all these amino acids linked together, and they're starting to fold. Now here's the step I want you to focus on. This protein is still attached to the ribosome by the last transfer RNA. It has to be cut free to go off and perform its job. This protein does that job. It's called release factor. Comes in here, hydrolyzes the ester bond there. There goes the protein off to fold. And then that comes back out. And then the whole machine is recycled by ribosomal recycling factor, which breaks the two halves apart so they can go off to find another messenger RNA strand. If I had to pick a machine to use to illustrate design in the cell, it would be the ribosome, because it's really much more important than any other machine in the cell. But let's focus just on that release factor. It's essential. If you don't have a release factor, that protein that I showed you that was coming out of the channel, it'll stay attached to the ribosome. It won't fold and it won't function. So release factor is an essential component. All right, let's generate our prediction. All living things share a common ancestor. I just showed you in that video how this system works. And by the way, that was in a prokaryote. We have a more complicated system in our eukaryotic cells. Similar in many respects, but different in others. Anyway, we know that we need that release factor for this system to work. That's an essential protein. So all living things share a common ancestor. We know how it works. What would you predict should be the structure of release factors in any cell that you look at, if all living things share a common ancestor? And in that common ancestor, there had to be a release factor. All right, so it's got a particular shape. It's inherited by its offspring. They go off and diverge. But it can't change much in its shape to do its job. So what would you expect here? Put those two together, what would you predict? They should be the same. If release factors are essential for any ribosome to function, and all living things share a common ancestor, when we look at different kinds of organisms, that protein should be largely identical. So there's a pretty clear prediction. And this happens all the time in evolutionary biology, where we take the theory of common descent, link it to other things that we know, and then we generate predictions that we can actually go out and check. All right. There is release factor from E. coli. These are the bacteria that normally inhabit your intestine. Pay attention to the shape of this. It's a molecular tool. It has a particular three-dimensional form that you can download from the protein data bank. Who wants to guess the shape of a eukaryotic release factor? Is it going to be the same or different? It's as different as it can be. You cannot superimpose these two proteins. They have completely different folds. They do the same job, but they're as different as a hammer and a saw. Probably a hammer and a saw actually have more commonalities than these two. When this was discovered, it shocked people. And you can go back and look, when this crystal structure was solved and compared to the one on the previous slide, people were shocked because what they expected to find was the same protein. They expected it because of the theory of common descent. Well, biochemistry is more, as I'm about to tell you in more detail, is a lot more surprising than that. This is a refutation of common descent if you let the data speak for itself. No one expected that these would have totally different folds. They do the same job, but they're not the same protein. So let's go back to our prediction. That's false. Now, someone over here has got to pay. The logic is relentless. If you make a prediction and it goes belly up, something in this bundle over here is responsible for that. And the question is it going to be this or that? And as I told you a moment ago, the practice of most evolutionary biologists is to keep the queen in her throne room. And they say, well, gosh, you know, there must be a way for translation termination mechanisms to evolve that we haven't discovered yet. This happens over and over in evolutionary biology, where common descent is insulated from observational challenge. What you could do is say, you know what, we know a lot about this. That's not true. Because somebody here has got to pay for that failed prediction because of the logic of the principle of continuity. Well, now let's turn on the bells and whistles. One prediction that was located out here in this counterfactual space was we should not find a lot of unique genes and proteins when we look at different kinds of organisms. If all living things share a common ancestor, the proteins that you have in your body, or a chimp, or a dog, or a blue whale, or as you go through the whole tree of life, should converge to the set that was present in the last universal common ancestor. That's how proteins are constructed. Now, the picture here, the cartoon, gives you the sense that we've searched most of this space. In fact, very little of it has been searched. Oh, that just shows that there wouldn't be that natural pathway. So if we found this, we'd have reason to doubt that that's true. In fact, only a tiny portion of the domain of common descent has been searched. A tiny fraction. Here's a way of thinking about it. It's a map of the world. And let's say you're a European explorer in the 16th century, 17th century, let's say, living here in the UK or France, perhaps. Every swan you've ever seen is white. That's the extent of your experience. Northern Africa, Europe, some of Scandinavia, all the swans you've ever seen are white. So you make the generalization. In fact, you put it into your logic textbooks, universally quantified proposition, all swans are white. You begin to explore, oh, all swans are still white. They're still white. We can really trust this generalization. All swans are white. And then you hit the western coast of Australia. And who knows what lives here in abundance? You find millions of them. Black swans. In fact, there was a book published recently called The Black Swan, talking about the effect of making discoveries that you didn't anticipate. That's a swan, and it's black. What happened was, as your sphere of experience increased, your initial generalization went belly up when you ran into an anomaly, into an exception. So you go back and you say, well, you know what? Not all swans are white. And what's happened within the past decade, the past 15 years in biology, as genome sequencing, the sequencing of DNA has become automated, is our sample of that domain has gotten a lot richer. This is a machine, an automated DNA sequencer, that didn't exist when I was a student. So when I was a student, we had to make do with a few protein and gene sequences from a few organisms. Now, we've got a lot more data. So this is when I was an undergraduate, started graduate school. And what this figure shows is the growth of gene sequence information in GenBank. Richard Sternberg, who is a colleague of mine, actually was at SMU last week, used to work at GenBank in Washington. He curated the fish DNA sequences there. And this is a rapidly rising curve of information. Most of what we know about the genetics of life has been learned within the past 10 to 15 years. We knew really basically nothing before then. Yet this is when evolutionary theory was put together. And what's happened now with the sequencing of DNA is we've had this huge fire hose, really it's a flood, of data dumped into biology that fundamentally challenge our perception of life. So we're finding not just black swans, plaid swans, multicolored swans, polka dot swans. And we're finding lots of points out here in that space that we said that's not going to be the case, that are the case. So let me give you one example of this that I find just endlessly exciting. It's called the puzzle of orphan genes. There's a pun here in the name. An ORF in molecular biology is an open reading frame. It's a sequence of DNA that codes for a protein. So in this little cartoon here, this is a sequence of DNA, and here at this end, we have a signal, a codon, that tells the ribosome start translating. So it's called the start codon. Then you have a long sequence of nucleotides that code for amino acids, and then you have a stop codon here. And they have characteristic features such that you can train a computer, you can write an algorithm to get a computer to look for them. Very much the way that natural language functions. Capital letter, period. And a string of characters here long enough to code for something that's intelligible. Because these features are so well defined, you can, as I said, write algorithms and have computers go looking for genes for you in the DNA that you sequence. And they're stored in GenBank, these sequences. There's a whole bunch of A's, T's, C's, and G's, that's a DNA sequence, and annotated with respect to their function. So let's say here's GenBank. Of course, there are millions of gene sequences there. This is just a few for the sake of illustration. Here's our newly sequenced piece of DNA, and we're going to compare them. We'll look at them base pair by base pair and try to align them, and we find a match. Those two sequences have a high degree of similarity. This one codes for a ribosomal protein. Well, that tells us then what this one does. But we can't put the sequences in here unless we know what they do, unless they have an associated function that's been attached to them. But in any case, we find the match, and it says, oh, okay, I see what I've got there. I've got a ribosomal protein because it matches this other one that I already knew about. So we can take the genes from a species, let's say it's a bacterial species that we've sequenced, and we put that into GenBank to get our matches back. Just find out what we're looking at. Here's a literary parallel, and we'll see how well-educated this audience is. Who knows where that's from? Might his quietus with a bare bodkin make? I heard Shakespeare. What play and what speech? Come on, you guys. Olivier, to be or not to be, it's from Hamlet. It's the famous soliloquy that Hamlet recites. Now, these little strings of English letters or characters are extinct, in a sense, in English. I never use quietus or bodkin in normal speech or writing or anything. The only time I see them is, if I'm reading Shakespeare, or if I hear them if I go to a performance of Hamlet. But there they are in an English sentence, and they're clearly performing a function. Now, let's say you're an eighth grader, you've got to read Hamlet, you see those words, you don't know what they mean, so you take them to the dictionary to find their associated meanings. It comes back, quietus is death, and bodkin's a little dagger, a little knife. Now you know what they're doing in that sentence. What Hamlet is saying is, in that famous soliloquy, I could kill myself if I wanted to. In any case, these words now have associated meanings. You know what they're doing. Well, the parallel to orphans is really very strong. Here is all the DNA from an organism that we've sequenced. There's the stuff that we know about, and then there are the orphans. Now, the pun in the name comes from the fact that they don't have parents. They don't have any molecular parents. They're orphan genes, if you will. These ones have matches. These ones don't. Imagine I give you a book to read, you open it, and every 10th word is something you've never seen before. So you go to the dictionary, your Webster's, or you go to dictionary.com online, you punch in the character string, and it comes back, we don't know. I don't know what it is. These genes are clearly genes because they have the features that characterize genes, yet they have no matches in GenBank. Hence the name orphans. Now, when this was discovered, it caused a lot of head-scratching. Russell Doolittle at UCSD actually has debated Duane Gish and other creationists. He's a member of the National Academy of Sciences. And he has spent his career working on this problem of building this gene tree of life. In 2002, in a review article in Nature, he's sort of looking at this problem, and he says, we've got a real puzzle here. In every genome so far that we've sequenced, there are vast numbers of genes for proteins of unknown function. It's the biggest surprise in genome sequencing. Now, what he's looking at is actually here, and we have had a considerable increase in information since that time. So he's looking at the situation right about at this point, looking at this first sort of collection of data and noticing this pattern. He goes on, where did this come from? How could there be so much unknown equipment? Where these unique sequences are coming from and what they do remain baffling mysteries. Now, there's an Israeli team, Dan Fisher and Naomi Sue, who have been working on this problem, and for a long time, Naomi maintained a webpage called The Orphanage where she kept track of these sequences. But in a review paper that they wrote and published in the next year, they said each of these orphans represents a mystery awaiting interpretation. How could their sequences have diverged so far that we can't find their parents? If evolution works through descent with modification, why don't we find similar sequences in other organisms? Where are the intermediates that must have given rise to them? If you think about English words and how they enter the language, let's take the word ripoff, which came into the language sometime in the late 1960s. It's now in the dictionary. Prior to the middle 60s, it wasn't there. Ripoff is a conjunction of rip and off, and hippies needed a word to describe what happened when someone took their bag of weed. Man, he ripped me off. That was a ripoff. But rip and off already had an existence in English. You could have found them in the dictionary prior to that point. So if you want to know the origin of ripoff, you just look at the meanings of each of the parts, follow them back, and you can trace the history of that word back into time. It's very, very rare for a word to enter English entirely out of the blue without any sort of precedent. Normally, the words that become new words have been coined from previously existing words so that we can trace their history back in time. The problem with orphans is we can't find their parents. Doolittle put it this way. He said, we expected, and this is a review paper now a couple of years later, that we would be able to build that tree of genes back to the last universal common ancestor because we thought we knew how evolution worked. So there's a gene sequence, and let's say it codes for that protein, and there are some evolutionary processes that affect that sequence, and it changes the protein that it's coding for. So you add a structure here that wasn't present there, but you still have a signal of history because those are very similar in terms of their overall geometry. The reason is the sequence coding for them is largely identical. There just have been a few changes. That gives you a path to trace back in time. So if we're up here, all the genes and proteins in our body find their history working our way back down our evolutionary lineage to the last universal common ancestor. That's the starting set. That's the view that Doolittle has in his mind. So what he's got there, his mental furniture, is this is a given. It's just the way the world is. All living things are related. We think we understand how evolution works. Given one and two, the very last thing we should expect to see are a lot of genes that don't have parents. That's why he's surprised. Because in the back of his mind is this and that gives him an expectation then that he takes into the world. He doesn't expect to find these orphans. So there's a group in the UK, now this is 5 years ago, so this is getting a little bit long in the tooth for a review paper, but I want to tell you a story associated with this. They wanted to know, how is this trend going to go? How is it going to continue? And they said, the abundance of these orphan genes is among the greatest surprises uncovered by the sequencing of genomes, this DNA sequencing project. Is this trend going to continue? And they say, well, look, it seems to be continuing to rise in a roughly linear fashion. So we sequence a new genome, we find new orphans. And despite the large number of genomes that we've sequenced, this trend shows no sign of leveling off. All right, here's a picture, a figure, excuse me, from their paper, where you've got orphans here versus non-orphans on this axis. So this is the axis of interest in terms of the number of orphans. And what they've done with their data is they've divided it into two bins. Orphans that are longer than 150 amino acids and those that are shorter. So they've got proteins of two different sizes with an arbitrary cutoff at 150 amino acids. And notice that these lines are not coming down. At this point, when this species had its gene sequenced, and this one, you get a big jump because they had a lot of orphans. But this line is continuing off at a 45-degree angle. It's not coming down. Now, here's the story. At about the time this paper came out, I read it, I thought, oh, that's interesting, and I put it in a talk that I was going to give at Dartmouth. And I gave my talk, and there was a microbiologist sitting right down in the front row. Room was jammed. Came to the Q&A, I'm sort of like, you know, quaking in my shoes, and I opened it up for questions. His hand shoots up, he wants to ask the first question. He said, Paul, that's a terrible way to generalize in biology. He said, that's a very small number, put it in the numerator position, with respect to the denominator, which is all the millions of species of prokaryotes on Earth. So we've got millions and millions of species of bacteria, eukarya, single-celled organisms, and thousands of diverse environments. And you're generalizing, he said, on the basis of a tiny sample of that space. He said, you're bound to be wrong. That curve will flatten out. Just the way that if I gave you a job to write a dictionary of English, eventually you would run out of finding new words. You'd come back to me and you'd say, you know what, Paul? I found a lot of words originally, and then there just weren't any more to find, and that line will go flat. There aren't any more words to discover. This is a complete dictionary of the English language. So his argument was, this Dartmouth microbiologist, that curve's going to flatten out. And I had to kind of swallow my pride and say, well, yeah, I am kind of being bold here. 122 genomes is not a lot with respect to all the genomes that are out there. But I said, my hunch is that's going to go like this. It's not going to come down. Both of these lines will. Well, a little gloating here. This paper was published last year by two researchers looking at this problem, looking just at the bacteria. So they're looking at just one of the three major domains of life. And they did a sampling project where they looked, well, I'll describe what they did. They took 573 bacterial species and they sampled from their genomes at random. They picked genes out and then they said, who else in this 573 species has this gene? So it would be like having a bunch of books and you sample randomly from the words in those books and you ask, how many other books in my collection have the same word? Well, the would be in all of them. But anti-disestablishmentarianism might be in only one. That would be a unique word for that sample anyway. Well, here's what they found. I'm sorry, it's a little bit hard to see. But the pie chart here shows the gene distribution for a typical bacterial species. The smallest part of the pie are the genes that all bacteria share, 8% roughly. This second and largest slice are the genes that are specialized for some particular environment. They call them character genes. By far, the biggest number of genes are the ones that are unique. This big green ball here. These are genes found only in one species or its near relatives. Those are the orphans. And they fitted this data to a mathematical function. I won't go into the details. We're running out of time. But they said, on the basis of our analysis, the genetic diversity of bacteria is of infinite size. In other words, every time you sequence a new bacterial species, you will see genes that you'd never have seen before. So it would be like reading books, and every time you open a new book, every 10th word is a word you've never seen before. And some of those unique words, in a molecular sense now, are essential. Now, here's a great example. How many of you have the old-fashioned telephones with a spiral cord that connects the handset to the base? Does anybody still have those? What happens if you don't periodically disconnect the cord from the handset? It super coils, right? And you get this big knot. You can barely pull the phone away from the wall. So I know at home, I have one of those phones in my office. Probably once a week, I unplug it, let out all the coiling, so the line is relaxed, and plug it back in again. You've got to do that regularly. Well, bacteria, really every living thing, faces the same problem with their DNA. It's a spiraling double helix. And unless you have a molecular tool that will let out the supercoiling, DNA will not function. And there's a protein that does that job called the topoisomerase. It's a DNA disentangler. That's what it does. It makes, depending on the topoisomerase in question, cuts in the spiraling double helix to relax the DNA so it doesn't supercoil on itself. Now, this topoisomerase, that's a protein, is found in a single species. It's a great protein because it's stable under high temperature. The organism where you find it lives in very, very hot conditions. So this is a useful protein for lab kits where you have to have high temperatures. In any case, notice the title of the paper here, A New Fold of Mysterious Origin. And when you read the paper, the author, Patrick Fortier, says, how mean of Mother Nature to give this wonderful topoisomerase to a single species. It's doing a job that every cell has to do, but it has its own special way of doing it. Well, Fortier, intrigued by this, started to look at the distribution of topoisomerases in all of life. And it turns out to be just about as wild as you can imagine. Now, here's what he says in this paper on the first page. He says, one might expect to find in all cells just two topoisomerases that descended from the universal common ancestor, Leuca, that would have a DNA genome. Get this, an intelligent designer would probably invent only one topo 1 and only one topo 2 to help the task of future biochemists. The reality turned out to be quite different and more interesting. And here's the reality on the next slide. This is crazy. Underneath here, you can see the three main domains of life. We're in this one, we're eukaryotes. Here are the bacteria, this gray triangle here. And here are the major groups of the archaea, which is another kind of single-celled organism. These colored boxes here are the variety of topoisomerases that you find in different parts of life. And what he has to do here is he can't derive them from the branching point here, which is the last universal common ancestor, because there's no logic there. So what he does is he puts them off in ancient viral reservoirs. So there was an ancient viral topoisomerase that was adopted here. There was another one that was adopted here by these groups. This is not a clean branching diagram. That's a spaghetti bowl. But what he's dealing with is the fact that this essential function is being performed in different parts of the tree of life by fundamentally different proteins. They're doing the same job, but they're not the same molecular entity. It's interesting to me how he says an intelligent designer should have done it a certain way. Really, what he should have said is common descent predicted that. This makes a lot more sense on an intelligent design view than it ever does on an evolutionary view, and here's why. Here's the shared genes that these organisms have in common, illustrated by this kind of rust color. These are the unique sequences that they have and no other species does. Now, typically what we find is a significant portion of the genome of any species belongs just to that species and its near relatives and not to others. The problem is, on common descent, you've got to get that all from a common ancestor. So if we go back to our branching diagram here, if the unique genes in Chris and me, in Homo sapiens, the unique genes in the pine tree, and the unique genes in E. coli all have to come from here by some branching pattern, what's going to happen to the size of that genome? Love power. It's going to rapidly grow beyond anything that's biologically reasonable. In fact, this has come to have a name in the past couple of years in the evolutionary biology community. This is called the Genome of Eden. And biologists are saying we have to avoid a genome of Eden. It's not biologically reasonable that the last universal common ancestor could have given rise to all this molecular diversity. Ergo, there could not have been a tree of life in Darwin's sense. Ford Doolittle is a molecular biologist at Dalhousie in Nova Scotia. And in this paper, this is now 10 years ago, he said, there's no reason to think a single kind of cell was the progenitor to all of life. And this, by the way, is not a term of endearment or reality for someone like Ford Doolittle. These are mythical characters as far as he's concerned. In a paper 7 years later, he said, Darwin said we have a single tree. That was a fact of nature. But in light of these genetic data, there's no reason to think that everything can be fitted into a single tree. A universal tree of life, that postulate rests on an unproven assumption about pattern that is unlikely to be broadly true. So he, in the past decade, has said there never was that root. There must have been multiple independent starting points. Carl Woese, who's a member of the National Academy at the University of Illinois, in 2002 said, we've got to go beyond the doctrine of common descent. And these capital letters, by the way, are his. Again, this is not a term of affection for someone like Carl Woese. That's something you've got to break away from. This paper you can download. It's open access. Eugene Koonin runs a large lab at the NCBI in Washington. And in this journal, so if you enter the search terms in Google, Koonin and Big Bang, you can download this paper plus all the referee reports attached at the end. They're fascinating reading. He said, we've got a problem here, and my solution is to say a universal tree of life does not exist. It's not there. And his Big Bang view is that you have explosive events of the origination of biological information through the history of life that cannot be traced to common ancestry. What's remarkable about this paper, if you do download it, is several scientists respond at the end, and you can read their comments, and they say, you really shouldn't talk this way because intelligent design advocates will tell people about it. Probably a lot of you know Craig Venter. He was the person who independently ran a human genome sequencing project, sequenced his own DNA, if I remember correctly. And in 2007, at a meeting in Connecticut, he said, I don't buy it. I don't buy the universal common ancestor picture. There must have been thousands of recent common ancestors, and they are not necessarily so common, meaning that these starting points have some things in common, but a lot that's not. You've got multiple independent starting points. All right, I'm really running over. I apologize. Let me just finish. I'm going to skip through these examples to get to an interesting case from animals. Now, when I presented these data at a private meeting a couple of years ago, a very prominent Christian biologist, I won't say his name because it was a private meeting, but if I said it, you would instantly recognize it. He's a national figure. It was about as far away from me as that jar is. We were in a small room, and he put up his hands like this, and he said, Paul, nobody cares. Nobody cares. It's all prokaryotes. And prokaryotes are weird. Single-celled organisms are weird. Yes, they're important, but nobody cares. We don't see this pattern in animals. Well, you know what? He was wrong. Here are two gastropods. They're in the phylum Mollusca. According to evolution, they share a common ancestor. This is a limpet. This is called the ass's ear. It looks like the ear of a donkey, common name for that species. They share a common ancestor, so they both have a calcareous shell. You've seen these at the seashore. You don't get them in Chicago. You need salt water for these guys. So you guys get to see them, or forms very like them. Now let's do another little thought experiment. If they share a common ancestor, what's likely to be the case about how they build their shells, the proteins that they use? Probably going to be the same, right? Well, a group in Australia looked at that question, and they said, we'll sequence the DNA involved in building the shell for these two groups and compare it. and see how similar it is. And it turns out not to be similar at all. In fact, they were stunned by what they found. The secretome is the word that they use for the proteins that build the shell. 85% of those genes and their protein products in this species, that ass's ear form that I showed you on the previous slide, are novel proteins. Only 19% of them have matches in the other group. Their conclusion, the unexpected complexity and evolvability, that means, well, this is a lot different than we expected, is shocking. There are significant molecular differences in the ways in which gastropods synthesize their shells. So the evolutionary expectation that because they share common ancestry, the proteins involved in building this structure, which is essential to their existence, would be the same, is false. Common descent failed to predict the data here. Not hard at all, though, from a design perspective. Here's another case. Hydra, you may remember from high school biology. There's a group in Germany looking at how hydra build their unique form. And it turns out the genes that they use to do that are specific to that species. And you can download, this is another free access paper. You can download the paper for yourself and read it. And what they say is these genes are found not just in prokaryotes, but in all of life, these unique genes. Well, I'm almost 15 minutes past my stop time. I actually cut out a lot of material to try to get this in on time. I have a lot more discussion of orphans and what they signify, but I think decency indicates that we should stop, and I'm sorry for going over. I hope you found it interesting. But here's a prediction. You pay attention to this because it's not going to stop. DNA sequencing has become so rapid and so inexpensive that if you have, you know, $15,000 lying around, you can get your own DNA sequenced. And the speed at which and the volume with which this genetic data is coming into biology staggers the imagination. And you are going to see in the next 10 years a revolution in understanding about Darwin's tree of life. Because if we have to find a common source for all this genetic information, it's going to be impossible under current theories of gene and protein evolution. This is being driven by the data. The data, the evidence here, is in the driving seat. So pay attention to this pattern and watch what happens in the next decade. It's bound to be exciting. And thank you for being so unbelievably patient.